Good morning, this August 20, 2020 day. My name is Michael McCusker. To vote or to not vote, that is no longer a question, but a necessary priority as well as a guaranteed privilege for all American citizens who are 18 to 180. Especially relevant this presidential election year is that women have been eligible voters for a century now, since August 26, 1920. That year, the nation elected an earlier corrupt and useless president to his first term. The great fear of Warren G. Trump, this fervid centennial of women's suffrage, is that it will be the women who will boot him out of the White House and into a well-deserved jailhouse. This time, women are synergized. And now, I would like to read something that I have written. American women fiercely agitated for their right to vote in American elections all over the USA in the late 19th century, which they considered the next form of slavery to be overthrown, following the Civil War and the three constitutional amendments that made all men equal. The notorious Victoria Woodhull became the first woman to campaign for the presidency in 1872, forming her own Equal Rights Party. The famous suffragist Susan B. Anthony and 16 other women were arrested in Rochester, New York that same year when they attempted to vote in the presidential election. Anthony declared, "It is we, the people, not we, the white male citizens, nor we, the male citizens, but we, the whole people, who formed this nation. We formed it not to give the blessings of liberty, but to secure them," Anthony said, "not to the half of ourselves and the half of our posterity, but to the whole people, women as well as men. It is downright mockery to talk to women of their enjoyment of the blessings of liberty," Anthony said, "while they are denied the only means of securing them, provided by the Democratic Republican government, the ballot." Susan Anthony and her friend Elizabeth Cady Stanton, both white women, managed to persuade a generally reluctant Congress of all white males to vote on a constitutional amendment in 1878, which would have granted universal suffrage to women and men in the USA. Roundly defeated by the all-male Congress chorus, it was from then known as the Anthony Amendment, and it was reintroduced every year for the next 41 years until it finally became the 19th Amendment in 1919. The 19th Amendment is resplendently simple. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex. After four decades of defeat, deflection, and dithering, during which one state or another would lopsidedly concede to women's suffrage, only to recant it down when other states voted it up, President Woodrow Wilson, a scholarly, essentially racist Southern Democrat, spoke up for the Stanton Amendment in 1918. "The ear of the leader must ring with the voice of the people," Wilson said. The House of Representatives approved the Stanton Amendment as a result of Wilson's backing, but the Senate nixed it by two votes, but eventually did a turnaround the following year and reversed its long rejection to women's suffrage. By the end of March 1920, the 36 states necessary had ratified the amendment, literally by a squeak. The mother of a Tennessee representative told her son to be a good boy and cast the single winning vote for the volunteer state to give the U.S. Constitution its 19th Amendment, which was declared official on August 26, 1920. Carrie Chapman Catt and Nettie Rogers, authors of Woman Suffrage and Politics, The Inner Story of the Suffrage Movement, wrote in 1923, "Throughout the suffrage struggle, America's history, her privileges, her traditions, stood forth to indicate the inevitability of women's suffrage. Yet years went by, decade followed decade, and 26 other countries gave the vote to women, while America delayed. Why the delay? We think we have the answer. It was not an antagonist in public sentiment, nor yet an uneducated or indifferent public sentiment. It was the control of public sentiment, the deflecting and thwarting of public sentiment through the trading and trickery, the buying and selling of American politics. Kat and Rogers might also have written that not all women were considered equal. Black women in America were more or less left out of the 19th Amendment, despite the many black suffragists who sought the right to vote in tandem with white women, who for the most part ignored the chasm of voting rights that opened between them 100 years ago. And that leads me to read a story, an editorial actually, by the New York Times editorial board, The 19th Amendment, an Important Milestone in an Unfinished Journey. Historians who specialize in voting rights and African American women's history have played a welcome and unusually public role in combating the myths that have long surrounded the women's suffrage movement and the 19th Amendment, which celebrates its 100th anniversary, August 26th. In the lead-up to this centennial, these same campaigning historians have warned against celebrations and proposed monuments to the suffrage movement that seem destined to render invisible the contributions of African-American women like Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, Mary Church Terrell, Sojourner Truth, and Ida B. Wells, all of whom play heroic roles in the late 19th and early 20th century struggles for women's rights and universal human rights. In addition to speaking up for black women of the past, these scholars have performed a vital public service by debunking the most pernicious falsehood about the 19th Amendment, that it concluded a century-long battle for equality by guaranteeing women the right to vote. Americans who imbibed this fiction in civics classes are caught off guard when they hear the more complicated truth, that millions of women had won voting rights before the 19th Amendment was ratified, and millions more remained shut out of the polls after ratification. Indeed, as middle-class white women celebrated ratification by parading through the streets, African-American women in the Jim Crow South, who had worked diligently for women's rights, found themselves shut out of the ballot box for another half century and abandoned by white suffragists who declared their mission accomplished the moment middle-class white women achieved the franchise. As the distinguished historian Nancy Hewitt has shown, a lengthy campaign and a range of subsequent laws was required to fully open ballot access to others, including black women, Mexican Americans, Native Americans, Chinese Americans, and Korean Americans. Among those necessary laws were the repeal of the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1943 and the adoption of the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952, the 24th Amendment in 1964, and the Voting Rights Act in 1965, along with its amendments of 1970 and 1975. In other words, the 19th Amendment was one step in a long, racially fraught battle for voting rights that seemed secure a few decades ago, but face a grave threat today. History of Women's Suffrage provides a minutely detailed account of a movement that implicitly defined women as people who were white and middle class and renders prominent African Americans virtually invisible. For a long time, historians who relied on this history duplicated its omissions. The African-American historian Rosalind Terburg Penn, who died last year at the age of 77, discredited this lily white version of events by uncovering more than 100 black suffragists. In recent decades, historians have shown that black women were erased partly because they sensibly argued that gender discrimination and racism were interconnected problems that could not be neatly separated. Books and studies timed to coincide with the 19th Amendment centennial are rendering ever more candid and inclusive versions of this story, in recasting the vote, how women of color transformed the suffrage movement, for example. The historian Kathleen Cahill foregrounds the suffrage struggles of women of color as they played out in New York City's Chinatown, New Mexico, and elsewhere. Ms. Cahill shows how white suffragists worked with, and sometimes against, marginalized women, including Native Americans and Mexican Americans. In the forthcoming book, Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All, the historian Martha S. Jones offers a version of the suffrage and voting rights story that begins well before the 1848 meeting at Seneca Falls. The history she recounts continues into the 1960s and 70s with the work of revered African-American civil rights organizers like Septima Clark and Fannie Lou Hamer. Miss Jones argues that the elited black women were at the forefront of the quest for women's rights and were overlooked in history because they achieved their victories in civic and political organizations on the black side of the color line. Invisibility aside, she writes, African American women pointed the nation toward its best ideals. They were the first to reject arbitrary distinctions, including racism and sexism, as rooted in outdated and disproved fictions. They were the nation's original feminists and anti-racists, and they built a movement on these core principles. And that's a quote. The Seneca Falls Convention concerned itself with a number of women's rights issues, including ecclesiastical policies that excluded women from authority in churches. By then, Ms. Jones writes, black women in the African Methodist Episcopal Church had capped years of skillful organizing and alliance building by persuading church leaders to grant them licenses to preach. This achievement was built on the singular accomplishments of Jerina Lee, who in 1819, after years of rejection, became the first woman authorized to preach in the African Methodist Episcopal Church. The ever-broadening story of the women's rights struggle is opening public awareness to other standout black women as well. One of them is Mary Ann Shad Carey, who received a belated Times obituary 2 years ago. Carey was one of the first female lawyers in the country and is described as the first black woman in North America to edit and publish a newspaper. The paper, known as the Provincial Freeman, was founded in Canada in 1853 and became a forum for women to discuss their lives. In a letter to the editor, one woman, Dolly Bangs, told readers that it was counterproductive to discourage women from leadership roles in, quote, the afternoon of the 19th century, unquote. She urged women to take their fate into their own hands. It is her right, as her duty, to press boldly forward to her appointed task. Otherwise, who is guilty of burying her talent? Among the rising stars Carey championed in the Freeman was the African-American poet and anti-slavery orator Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, who would go on to an illustrious career. In 1866, Harper rattled the white suffrage elite in a prophetic speech delivered at the founding conclave of the American Equal Rights Association. She argued that the destinies of black and white, rich and poor, were all bound up together, and that racism was in fact a white woman's issue. Kicking off the abuses black women suffered daily, she thundered, "You white women speak here of rights, I speak of wrongs." Harper did not live to witness the unsettling contrast between scenes of middle-class white women celebrating the 19th Amendment with ticker tape parades and southern black women being driven from the polls under the threat of bodily harm. A half century after ratification, when African Americans were still being beaten and murdered for seeking the vote, the charismatic organizer Fannie Lou Hamer did not stand on the 19th Amendment. As Miss Jones writes, yes, she was a woman, but she did not see the terms of the 19th Amendment, the one that constitutionalized women's voting rights, as protecting her. The 19th Amendment can fairly be seen as an important milestone in an unfinished journey. It is morally repugnant and counterproductive to mythologize it as a triumph of egalitarianism at a time when the voting rights hammer and others paid for in blood are under attack in the courts and in state legislatures all over the United States. This disturbing fact needs to remain uppermost in mind as the country unveils its new suffrage monuments and holds its celebratory events. And that was the 19th Amendment, an important milestone in an unfinished journey by the editorial board of the New York Times. And that editorial board is a group of opinion journalists whose views are informed by expertise, research, debate, and certain longstanding values. It is separate from the newsroom. Unquote. Quote, unquote. And now, something I've read many times on this program, and actually read back in March on Women's History Month. The 26th of August by Leonora Murray. August 26th is not just another summer day. It is a day of remembrance, a special day which honors three generations of American women who successfully campaigned for 72 years and finally won a basic right of citizenship, the right to vote. One wonders how long it will take to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. Susan B. Anthony went to jail because she attempted to vote. A federal judge told her that citizen did not mean women. If we meant women, we would say woman. So, who says we don't need the ERA? I think all of us on the Oregon coast have feminist ancestors who endured ridicule, derision, distortion, and verbal and physical assaults to gain equality. We all have grandmothers and mothers, aunts, sisters, wives, daughters, sweethearts, and cousins, women who got thrown in jail for joining strikes, who got fired when asking for equal wages, who were denied access to training and education on the basis of sex, who marched and demonstrated, who still march and demonstrate. On August 26th, we should remember our folk heroes, the women who attended the first Equal Rights Conference in New York and published the Seneca Falls Declaration of 1848, the women who joined the Women's Party that Alice Paul founded, the women who were blue-collar workers and union organizers. We should remember them all with love and celebration. We should celebrate the gutsy Dr. Mary Wright, Congressional Medal of Honor winner. She was a battlefield surgeon for the Union Army. 50 years later, Congress decided she hadn't been brave enough and requested the medal be returned. She refused, so Congress denied her military pension. Unfortunately, no one bothered to take down her exact words, but they must have been dillies to make Congress take such strong action against her. We should celebrate Sojourner Truth. Her speech, "Ain't I a Woman?" made history when she asked if women were frail and weak, how come nobody kept her from working as a field hand, and if motherhood and women's sensitivity precluded them from public life, then where were those who worried about her sensitivity when her five children were sold into slavery? In one instance, she faced down a Bible-quoting mob, saying that she did indeed believe in Jesus, but that the men in the mob had nothing to do with Jesus. That was between God and women. No men anywhere. A very nice lady, a very tough lady. And we should not forget Sacagawea, pathfinder for the Messers, Lewis and Clark, or Lute Stone, who made up her own wedding vows and kept her own name, or Jane Addams, not only a great humanitarian, but the first woman to win the Nobel Prize, or Abigail Adams, who insisted to her husband, the great revolutionary and signer of the Declaration of Independence, that more than just men were created equal, or Amelia Bloomer, who tried so hard to make sense out of fashion, or Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who spent her life struggling for the rights of women. And most of all, we should celebrate the grand old lady, Susan B. Anthony, who said, "Failure is impossible." We must believe it, even if it takes another 72 years to get women written into the National Constitution and consciousness. She didn't forget the men either. On men's liberation, she said, "Of course, for not all men are the children of women." And most heartening and solemn of all, Susan B. Anthony said, "Until women have the same rights as men on this green earth, there shall never be another season of silence." We should all support our local daycare centers. We should join the local chapter of the National Organization of Women now, or start one. We should support our women's crisis centers. And best of all, we should celebrate our gallant women. And that was the 26th of August by Leonora Murray. She originally wrote this article for the North Coast Times Eagle in 1979. The 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which was ratified on August 18, 1920, and became law on August 26 that year, declares the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Although he opposed the ERA, Ronald Reagan, as president in 1982, declared August 26th as Women's Equality Day in recognition of the success of women's suffrage more than 60 years later. And now, about that Equal Rights Amendment, something I've written. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States by any state on account of sex. And that is the Equal Rights Amendment. The pretense that half the human race is unequal and subordinate to the other half is a persistent malignancy. It has been chronic through history, especially in periods when muscle and force held sensitivity and intelligence in thrall. Yet the need to be equal and free is the most stubborn human hunger. It has taken centuries for women to emerge from the dominance of their male counterparts. It took almost a century to gain the vote once they started campaigning for it. So it should be no surprise that the Equal Rights Amendment to the United States Constitution will not stay dead, however many times its grave has been dug. The ERA was last defeated on July 2, 1982. The date in 1776, the nation's forefathers declared themselves free from England's tyranny and promised equality to all men. The ERA failed even though it had support of 80% of the electorate because of a handful of men in three state legislatures. Five other states which had initially approved the measure subsequently rescinded their votes. Those who regard women as chattel celebrated and pronounced the ERA dead. The ERA has been sent to the grave notable times since Alice Paul wrote the amendment in 1923. On July 14, 1982, the same month as ERA's failure to be ratified on deadline, the same day celebrated as the beginning of the French Revolution in 1789, 51 U.S. senators and 201 representatives co-sponsored the ERA in both houses of Congress. That attempt also failed. A national referendum would probably make the ERA constitutional law within a few months. If it were on the ballot, this centennial celebration of women's suffrage, especially with the vigorous and mega massive rising up against Donald Trump's gangrenously cruel-hearted misogyny toward women and minorities. In particular, the radical empowerment of women has been a contravailing result of the malfeasant incompetence of the Trumpy Dumpty Inquisition. The prevailing climate of throw the bums, Trump bums, out just might expeditiously zoom the usual torturous process of ratification and confirm ERA by election time in November if Congress reaffirms it right away, which would give the disgraced Senate an opportunity to redeem itself. Whatever process makes the ERA law of the land, it is imperative that gender equality be explicitly spelled out and guaranteed. It must be done quickly. As Susan B. Anthony said, there shall never be another season of silence until women have the same rights men have on this green earth. And Eleanor Roosevelt, women must get into the political game and stay. And now, in memory of Rick Sanders, and this is something I wrote. Perhaps some of you remember the 1972 Olympic Games in Munich, Germany, when the Israeli team was virtually annihilated by radical masked Muslims known as Black Saturday. You might even remember that a USA Olympian from Oregon was a silver medalist for wrestling. His name was Rick Sanders. A year earlier, following his nomination for the U.S. team, Rick had been arrested while visiting friends in his birth state of Pennsylvania. He went to a party one night, and later he was arrested walking in the middle of a nearly deserted highway, naked, and stealing a police car from a cop who stopped him. That happened twice, until a third cop car managed to get him to jail. The Pennsylvania State Police would only drop the charges and reinstate his Olympic eligibility if he returned a year later with letters from almost every prominent Oregonian vouching that he had kept his nose clean. He especially made sure notable Oregon law enforcement and judicial persons were included in his collection of endorsements. In February 1972, a group of Oregon members of Vietnam Veterans Against the War, who were driving to a national VVAW meeting in Denver, Colorado, gave Rick a ride and hooked him up with vets from Pennsylvania, who happily gave Rick and his packet of letters a ride to his birthplace exoneration. Reinstated in the Olympics, at which several Israeli athletes were murdered by the Black Saturday terrorists, Rick won his silver medal. Rick and a woman who was an Olympian, a javelin thrower from California, decided to hitchhike to Greece together. The driver of a car that picked them up in Yugoslavia on a rainy day crashed into a bus, and all three were killed. That was 48 years ago this month. Several years afterward, a former Astoria High School wrestler named Mark Davis described to me the Rick Sanders move, which he said was a last resort attempt to get out of a fix and win a wrestling match. He has since died also. All these years later, among many Oregonians who knew Rick Sanders well, his memory still is accompanied with a shock at his startling death. This is Michael McCusker. And from David Horowitz, whose 79th natal day was Monday, 8/17, a cognitive test for the American people. One, who said that warnings about COVID-19 were a hoax and fake news? Two, who said that the virus would disappear on its own? Three, who said that internal applications of bleach might act as a cure? Four, who said he took no responsibility for curbing the pandemic? Five, who answered, "It is what it is," in response to the death of 158,000 Americans. The good news is that there is only one answer to all five questions, and you've aced the test. The bad news is that there is only one answer to all five questions, and we are all in mortal danger. Yesterday was my birthday. I am Jack Benny's age, plus 40. This pandemic year, I feel as I did on my 25th birthday in Vietnam, measuring my chances to be 26. As it happened, I arrived back in the USA a year later on my 26th birthday, alive and comparatively safe. The late Geraldine Ferraro was born on August 26, 1935. She said when she became the first woman vice presidential candidate in 1972, for the Democrats, "All issues are women's issues." Stay safe, and you will help everyone else stay safe also.